This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Stay tuned for a look at a local big corporate takeover. Some craft beer lovers are wondering if Anheuser-Busch InBev's buyout of Nelson County's Devil's Backbone Brewery is a sellout. Jesse Nadler talked with the CEO, and she also took a look at a controversial approach to the problem of feral cats in Rockbridge County. Also, as public school enrollment around Virginia becomes less and less white, take a look at the stubbornness of segregation among our schools. Also, we've got this week's edition of Our Island Universe, but first, a conversation we had last week about the problem of child sexual abuse. The news leader in Stanton spent 6 months investigating the scope of the problem in Virginia. Their series is called Prey: Sexual Predators Are Hunting Our Children. I spoke with the lead reporter on the series, Brad Zinn. Brad, your investigation into this issue, the whole thing leads with this sentence. Children in Virginia are being sexually abused at a rate that would alarm the public if the breadth of the problem were truly understood. What is the scope of the problem?
Based on the reporting that the numbers we could pin down, children under the age of 18 right now, about 360,000 kids will face some type of child sex abuse in Virginia alone. The problem with this, and the reason people think this might even be higher, is because, you know, most of these cases go unreported.
Right.
And that's a big issue. I mean, some experts say 9 out of 10 instances.
Wow.
So, it is a very high number. And, you know, you see these numbers, and depending on what statistics you check, 1 in 4 girls will be abused, 1 in 6 young boys.
One in four girls, 1 in 6 boys. And those are national statistics.
Yes, yes. And some say 1 in 7 boys. I mean, it all differs slightly, but
right.
I think it points to a pretty large problem that continues.
But from the research that you did, are there kids in certain situations that are more at risk, maybe in terms of family income or age or even where they live?
You will read, and I've seen this as a cops and crime reporter for the newspaper for a number of years. The abusers themselves, and it sounds cliched, but they do come from all walks of life, young and old. You know, I've done cases that involved elderly people, young people. You know, obviously there's a lot of juvenile sex abuse that we really didn't tap into in this article, but it's a large percentage. I think it's over 20% is the Justice Department's numbers.
More than 20%.
I believe so.
That are actually children themselves, somebody under the age of 18 abusing someone else.
Abusing another child.
Right.
And that's prevalent.
Most of us are probably aware that these types of cases are very difficult to prosecute, let alone get a conviction to get the abuser pay for the crime. What are some of the main obstacles in the way of punishing abusers?
One is, you know, there's not a lot of evidence in some of these cases, and you get a lot of what they call he said, she said cases. Certain jurisdictions have a higher percentage of cases that they will prosecute, as opposed to other jurisdictions, and that varies, you know, across the state. Now, when you have a very young victim, it is tough to put that child on the stand, and some of these kids are just too young to put on the stand, and, you know, a good defense attorney, or even an adequate defense attorney, can turn a child around on the stand.
Sure.
and put doubt in the jury's mind and or the judge's mind.
Well, and one thing that you mentioned too in this investigation is that depending on the jurisdiction, not all courts are set up well for children's testimony. That is, maybe using closed circuit TV.
Right.
To separate them from the courtroom environment.
Right. You don't see that a lot. I've only seen it maybe once or twice, but it is available.
Well, and one of the problems that you identify in all this, and this comes from so many people who actually work with these kids, is that these cases often, you mentioned that there are often no witnesses. It's kind of a he said, she said, or,
right.
You know, victim says versus the abuser, and that's all you've got. So the cases turn on the child reporting the abuse a lot of times, and getting them to talk about the abuse re-victimizes the child all over again. So what did you find that are some of the best practices involved in getting that information in a way that can actually be taken to court?
You know, we talked about this a lot, the Child Advocacy Centers of Virginia, and our area here in Augusta County does have one. What that is, you know, they will go to this center. Let's say a referral comes through Child Protective Services. They say, you know, we think this child's, you know, been sexually abused. Well, they will take this child to this advocacy center where there will be a team of specialists involving a prosecutor, a forensic interviewer, social services, et cetera. And they will place this child in a comfortable environment, and they will watch this interview. They will record this interview, and they will feed the forensic interviewer questions, non-leading questions, because really they're trying to get to the truth. They're not trying to pin a conviction on an innocent person is what they're doing at these centers.
Right.
And so that child, in theory, now it doesn't always work out this way, but in theory, you know, instead of this child having to tell, you know, several different people the same story over and over, say, tell a police officer or tell a social worker, then tell the police officer, then, you know, or tell their teacher, you know, this way they can just tell this story in theory, just tell this story once, and then it'll go to the court system. And because, you know, there is trauma for that child to keep retelling that event, which obviously is an extremely traumatic event, and an event that the child, quite frankly, doesn't fully understand, I would imagine. And so they can tell this story, they have it recorded, and they have the child's, you know, not testimony, but the child might have to testify in court later on, but at least for the time being, that's the only time they have to really come out of the shell and tell this awful tale about what happened to them.
Other than the child advocacy centers that you dive into in this reporting, are there any new services available for families to prevent the problem in the first place? And what can the average person do?
Right. Well, there's a couple of agencies, but one that we are dealing with is the Darkness to Light. They have a program called Stewards of Children, and what it is it's a child sex abuse prevention training. And we've already sponsored through that Stewards of Children. We've already sponsored, I believe it's 16 individuals, coaches, teachers, and put them through this training. And basically, the more people that can prevent and or spot child abuse, it offers a wider net of protection.
Brad, this is a really impressive investigation into an alarming issue. Thanks for the reporting, and thanks very much for taking the time to talk with us about it.
No, I really appreciate the opportunity.
Brad Zinn is a reporter for the News Leader in Stanton, where he focuses on police and the courts. Devil's Backbone, the 8-year-old craft brewery headquartered in Nelson County, was recently bought for an undisclosed sum by global beer giant Anheuser-Busch InBev. Now, some Virginia fans of the scruffy indie brand are questioning whether the label has sold out. Jesse Nadler sat down with CEO Steve Crandall to find out what's in store for the Virginia brewery.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Welcome to Devil's Backbone.
Hours after news broke that Devil's Backbone, the beloved locally owned craft brewery headquartered in Nelson County, was being sold to Anheuser-Busch InBev, one thing quickly became clear. Beer drinkers, particularly craft beer drinkers, can be territorial about their favorite local brew. The Devil's Backbone Facebook page blew up with comments from many fans dismayed and disappointed by the company's decision to sell to what some perceived as the quote-unquote man. How does a local label built on edgy independence make the leap into the arms of the world's largest beer maker without alienating its core customer? Tim Johnson from Lynchburg is one of those core customers. He's been drinking Devil's Backbone's 8-point IPA for about 6 years. He says that while he understands the company's decision to sell, he prefers to keep his beer dollars with the little guys.
My revenue or money I have to put into the industry are going to go to smaller groups that need my backing more so than someone who now has the backing of a large corporation.
Devil's Backbone CEO Steve Crandall is aware that some customers are skeptical of the sale.
Brewers are interesting people. You know, they're sort of anti the man.
But he had to sell to keep thriving. The company had already grown at a fast clip, some 350% since 2008.
You know, as you know, yes, we sold to Anheuser-Busch a controlling interest, and it was, in our lifespan of this business, something that we had to do. From a financial standpoint, we were tapped out.
What does selling to a global corporate behemoth get you? Terms of the agreement were not disclosed, but ABI is expected to invest $25 million in infrastructure and equipment improvements in the company. This includes its brew pub in Nelson County and a 35,000-square-foot brewery in Lexington. The brewery will expand by 50,000 square feet. The size of the workforce at the Lexington facility is expected to increase from 60 to 120. 401k matching funds for employees will go from 1% to 6%.
We're going to be able to do some amazing things with beer. And not only with beer, we're going to do some amazing things in our communities. You know, we're going to have more opportunity to support our communities like we've never been able to do before, and we're certainly going to be able to improve the lives of our employees.
In the beer industry, craft is where the growth is. Total beer sales dipped 0.2% last year, while craft beer sales increased 12.8%, according to the Brewers Association.
Craft is so exciting for the bigger guys because the bigger guys, their footprint's filled out. A little guy like me, we're just scratching the surface. We have a huge amount of room to run.
News of the sale coincided with the announcement that Oregon-based Deschutes Brewery will begin construction on its East Coast production facility in Roanoke in 2019. The facility is expected to create more than 100 jobs. Both announcements signal Virginia's growing significance in the craft beer industry, going from around 50 craft breweries in 2011 to roughly 124 in 2015, according to the Brewers Association. Here's Governor Terry McAuliffe at the Deschutes announcement, commenting on the state's craft beer boom.
Because Virginia is for beer lovers, folks.
I'm Jesse Nadler reporting.
There are 80 million feral cats in the United States, according to some estimates, and the question of how best to curb overpopulation on the local level has been a real issue in Rockbridge County. Cat advocates are alarmed by the high rate of euthanasia at the county shelter, arguing for a more humane approach. Reporter Jesse Nadler heads to Buena Vista, ground zero of the cat controversy, to find out more about this new approach and whether it actually works.
What does a county do when it's overwhelmed by homeless cats? That's what many Rockbridge County residents are asking themselves as the county grapples with a cat crisis. The conventional approach is to round up the cats, bring them to the local shelter, where they'll all be spay and neutered and hopefully adopted. It's a nice thought, except it doesn't happen that way. At the Rockbridge County SPCA, which serves the cities of Buena Vista and Lexington, 68% of the more than 1,200 cats brought to the shelter last year were euthanized. Nearly 7 of every 10 cats were put down. The Rockingham-Harrisonburg SPCA's numbers were just as dismal. The Augusta County shelter, meanwhile, had a feline kill rate of only 7%. The Rockbridge County numbers alarm residents like Joanne Abel. She presented the statistics to a packed Board of Supervisors meeting last month.
I just think our shelter is operating in an archaic model, and they're not educating themselves on all the ways they could be helping cats.
Abel and her supporters want the Rockbridge SPCA to be more aggressive about seeking funding for high-volume, low-cost spay-neuter programs.
The Augusta County Pound just recently got a $50,000 grant from Petco Foundation to help fund their spay-neuter program.
These funds have allowed the Augusta County Shelter to streamline the process and make it less expensive than at the Rockbridge SPCA. Tara Rohde is the executive director of the Rockbridge Shelter. She's aware the euthanasia rate for cats is high, but she says it's also because hers is the only shelter in the county. Augusta County has two.
When you get 200 cats in 1 month, that's a lot. We get the feral cats in, they're not in the best of shape. They might have 3 teeth in their head, or they've got a horrible ringworm situation. You know, it's never easy. It's not a fun part of the job.
Feral cats are also aggressive. They bite. They scratch. They can attack employees.
We are working in June, hopefully putting together a low-cost spay and neuter program that will allow some people, low-income families, to utilize some funding that will be there.
There is another way to deal with cat overpopulation, but it's unconventional and kind of controversial.
Possum! Leo! Sundance! Come on, Possum! There's Possum. Hey, Bybee.
This is where Mary Huffman from Buena Vista comes in. Buena Vista, which has a lot of poverty, is home to the biggest known cat colony in the area. More than 100 homeless cats had taken over parts of Glenmorey Park.
And you could see them. They were just running everywhere. I mean, literally everywhere.
It's called Trap, Neuter, and Release, or TNR. Instead of killing the cats, Mary takes care of them.
What I feed every month here is probably anywhere from $120 to $150 a month. It's because I love my community. I love my city so much and my park so much that I'm willing to do this part.
Mary teamed up with the cat rescue group Cats Unlimited to trap, vaccinate, and alter all the cats in the colony. Their ears were notched to signify their status. The cats were then returned to the park to live the rest of their lives in the great outdoors.
Some people within council that would like to see all the cats gone from the park. That's not realistic.
There is no question that TNR is more humane if the fixed cats are returned to a caretaker. But there is some debate whether TNR on its own is effective as a population control. Cats simply reproduce too quickly. An unfixed female can give birth to 5 litters every year. And, Tara Rohde points out, what's to stop animal control from picking up those fixed cats and bringing them right back to the shelter?
Do you know how many nicks and scratches and torn spots are on their ears? A bunch, because they get in fights. So it's hard to tell whether it was this notch because they were spayed or neutered, or is this because of a fight.
For TNR to be truly effective, it needs to be combined with aggressive adoption strategies. Mary Huffman is all about this. Under her care, the size of her colony has dropped from 102 to 19, all fixed but one.
I've got people now that run from me at the grocery store. They're afraid I'm going to ask them to take a cat.
For WMRA News, I'm Jessie Nadler.
My family's got cats now, and my friends have got cats.
For the first time last fall, more students of color than white students walked into public schools for first grade. But even as this country gets more diverse, many school systems still remain segregated. To help understand why and what can be done, a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University compared approaches to integration taken by 4 southern cities. As Mallory Nopain reports, the least successful was right here in Virginia.
Genevieve Siegel Hawley pulls up a series of maps on her computer.
Let me find one that would have Richmond.
The first is of Richmond City and its suburbs. You can see how neighborhoods break up by race, and on top of that are small pie charts, some mostly red, some mostly green.
Red represents the share of white students, green represents the share of black students. And so you can see in Richmond that the housing population very much determines the makeup of the school.
That makes sense. Where the neighborhoods are primarily white, the school's population is primarily white, and vice versa. But it also means the map is filled with stark contrast. In Richmond City, the pie charts are all green. In the surrounding counties, they're completely red. This map isn't from the 1950s or 60s. It's from the 90s. Siegel Hawley pulls up the 2010 version, and it's not much different.
And you can see in Richmond, the segregated minority schools in Richmond stay virtually the same. But the big difference is that there's some growing diversity in the suburbs.
That diversity, though, still isn't spread out. It's clustered in certain schools. But Siegel Hawley doesn't despair. Her research also involves other southern cities, some showing a successful way to integrate schools. Jefferson is a county surrounding the city Louisville, Kentucky. But instead of having 2 separate school systems, think inner city versus suburb, they both fall under 1 very large district.
Today they're under a controlled choice plan, which means that everybody makes a choice.
Genevieve Siegel Hawley is a researcher at Virginia Commonwealth University. She compared 4 different cities in the South that took different approaches to reducing segregation. She says Louisville's regional plan with controlled choice has largely been successful.
Everybody ranks a set of schools that they'd be interested in going to, and the district looks at those rankings, and they make the final assignment decision based on a lot of things.
They assign kids based on location, where their siblings might be, and whether it will create more diverse schools. Siegel Hawley says the community there has chosen to prioritize diversity.
This generation of kids is going to have to know how to live with and work with one another in order for our society to be successful. And schools reach 9 out of 10 kids in our country, public schools. They absolutely should be places where we help children learn to live and work together.
Siegel Hawley recently published a book about this research. It's available now and is called When the Fences Come Down, 21st Century Lessons from Metro School Desegregation. In Richmond, I'm Mallory Nopain.
I'm Chanel Verani, and this is Our Island Universe. The Earth spins once on its axis every day. That means at the equator, the Earth is spinning at about 1,000 miles per hour. At that speed, a trip from New York to Los Angeles would take about 2.5 hours. But as the Earth rotates, it also orbits the Sun at 67,000 miles per hour. Dizzy yet? It turns out our Sun, and hence our solar system, is whizzing around the center of the Milky Way galaxy at about 490,000 miles per hour. At that rate, a trip from New York City to Los Angeles would take about 20 seconds. But even our galaxy is not at rest. The galaxies in our part of the observable universe are rushing out at a speed of nearly 620 miles per second. Our New York City to Los Angeles trip would take about 4 seconds, about the length of time for me to say, "Beam me up, Scotty." So given all these dizzying speeds, why don't we feel any of these motions? It's because Earth and everything on it moves at a constant rate, carrying you as the passenger right along with it. To our ancestors, seeing the stars, the sun, the moon, rise and set every day naturally led them to conclude the Earth was stationary and that the celestial sphere above moved around us. But the reality is, we're on a rocket ship racing through space. I am Chanel Verani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bib, Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltz, Swiss Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. To learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. You'll find all of our stories from the newsroom at the website, too. And be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning.